Today at Reader's Corner, Stefan Bechtel, author of Mr. Hornaday's War, How a Peculiar Victorian Zookeeper Waged a Lonely Crusade for Wildlife That Changed the World.
You know, here's this guy who becomes world famous for being a conservationist, who started out as a trophy hunter. One of many grinding contradictions in his life. He starts a movement to create the first national zoo, where they will begin captive breeding programs to restore the buffalo, this magnificent species, which is a whisper away from extinction. There wasn't a sense of the urgency that Hornaday had. A lot of people got tired of him because he was asking them to change.
I'm Bob Custra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. In 1886, William Temple Hornaday set out for the untamed West to collect American bison specimens for the U.S. National Museum. Just a few years earlier, the number of free-roaming bison had been estimated in the millions, but Hornaday had a hunch that had changed. He was right. The taxidermist was barely able to find enough specimens to preserve for the museum, and the rapid slaughter of this North American icon would drive him to try to fight for their survival and that of other wildlife for the rest of his life. Author Stefan Bechtel writes about Hornaday in this chapter in American Conservation History in his recent book, Mr. Hornaday's War, How a Peculiar Victorian Zookeeper Waged a Lonely Crusade for Wildlife That Changed the World. The book documents how Hornaday became the most influential conservationist of the 19th century, devoting his life to protecting endangered species. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Stefan Bechtel. He is a founding editor of Men's Health magazine and the author of 10 other books. His work has appeared in Esquire, The Washington Post, American Way, and other publications. Mr. Bechtel joins us by phone for this interview. Stefan Bechtel, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
So this is clearly a guy who was forgotten by history. As I told you before the show here, I never heard of this guy, and I suppose there's many who really hadn't, unless maybe they visit Yellowstone and see a name that looks familiar. Tell us about who this guy was.
My editor on this book went to Yellowstone a couple years ago, and there's actually a mountain named Mount Hornaday in Yellowstone. And so she asked the park ranger, you know, where is it? And he'd never heard of it. So his slide into obscurity is nearly complete. I was actually asked to give a talk to the National Bison Association a few months ago in Denver. This is a big bison ranchers. And I went out there, and I was amazed to discover that most of these guys had heard of him and knew quite a bit about him and knew a few things I didn't know. So there are these pockets of intense interest in his life.
So tell us a little bit about how he got to the West, because he was working back east, and then all of a sudden he decides to take this trip to come back with some specimens.
Yeah, in 1886 he was the very youthful but fairly famous chief taxidermist at the U.S. National Museum, which later became the Smithsonian. And his boss one day said, well, you know, go back in the back and get, you know, find some specimens that we have of the Bison americanus, and let's put together a display. So he goes back there and comes back in utter dismay because there weren't any. I mean, here is the People's Museum in Washington, D.C., that didn't have a single specimen of the most magnificent quadruped in North America. So he mounted this quick expedition and went out into the Montana Territory in the spring of 1886 and was told by everyone when he got there that there was no way he'd ever find any. They were all gone. And he did manage to see a few distantly and then came back that fall when the skins were better for dressing out and display and conducted what later became known as the last buffalo hunt.
Now, you point out in your book that Hornaday didn't just hunt buffalo. He was a big game hunter in other countries he traveled. Was that before or after he headed west? Was he already into the business of big game hunting? Again, all in the interest of science, because I think you also say that he was bringing these things back to place in museums.
Well, when he was fresh out of college, what later became Iowa State University, he'd gotten interested in taxidermy. you know, stuffing birds and animals, which at the time was sort of like the Discovery Channel of nature, because there was no way anyone could see many of these animals in life. There was only one zoo in the entire United States in Philadelphia. And he became a very masterful taxidermist. And so he right out of college, he got a job at this place called Ward's Natural Science Establishment, sort of a Sears Roebuck of nature specimens, where you could order this catalog and you could order geodes and fossils and bones and also stuffed animals. So he worked as a taxidermist there for a while, but then sort of graduated to specimen collecting. So he was sent afield as a very young man to first to the Everglades and then to South America, the Orinoco, and eventually to the interior of Borneo as a hunter and bringing back these specimens for Ward's. In fact, went to some of the most remote places on the planet and saw things that few people had ever seen before.
So this was an era when it was simply impractical to bring live animals back, so they brought dead ones back? Is that basically sum it up?
Pretty much. And of course, you know, here's this guy who becomes world famous for being a conservationist, who started out as a hunter, a big game hunter, a trophy hunter. One of many grinding contradictions in his life was that one. You know, people like Theodore Roosevelt, who was a colleague and friend of his, is also kind of endlessly pictured with these piles of dead animals. But yet he became perhaps the greatest conservationist in our history.
How vast were these bison herds that roamed North America before they were all slaughtered?
Well, when I was younger, the number that was thrown around was 60 million. But now there's a biologist named Tom McHugh who did these estimates based on the carrying capacity of the Great Plains and came up with a number closer to 30 million. Nobody knows exactly what the number is, but either way, it's almost inconceivably vast.
And why were they hunted to extinction or near extinction? It wasn't just Native Americans, although there's an interesting story there, but some of our own government folks were doing it as well.
Exactly. I mean, there were practical uses. These lap robes, buffalo robes, were said to be the warmest robes to put on your lap when you're in an open carriage. And there were industrial uses for the leather and making belts for machinery and, of course, the tongue and the meat and so on. But also, as you point out, the decimation of the bison became the de facto policy of the United States government, where we were conducting these Indian wars in the West, and it became pretty obvious that the best way to win that war was to destroy the Indians' food supply. And it was nakedly stated. There was a guy named Columbus Delano, who was a Secretary of the Interior, who, you know, looked like an Old Testament prophet. He had these baleful eyes, and he just came right out and said, "If we're gonna win this war, we've got to wipe out the buffalo." And so that was what was happening. So there were the buffalo was being destroyed for many different reasons,
and even from moving trains, people were shooting at these herds.
Exactly. I mean, there were these pictures, etchings in Harper's Weekly magazine of, you know, ladies all dressed up, and men, they wouldn't even put out their cigar. They would just be shooting right out the train window, and very often they would just leave the carcasses scattered across the plains. And when Hornaday went west in 1886 and actually saw this, he saw what looked like a Civil War battlefield. As far as the eye could see, these carcasses, sometimes they had been stripped of their hides. They rarely took the skin off the head. So they're these enormous sort of tribal heads just laying there and just bones everywhere.
I think you even said something about the fact that the Native Americans actually had some kind of a process where they drove them off cliffs in the thousands.
That's true. You know, I think it used to be thought that the Native Americans were completely blameless in the destruction of the buffalo, but now there's been these archaeological excavations at these buffalo jumps in the West where fantastic numbers. I suppose it would be very difficult to drive a herd over a cliff and only, you know, get 10, but the whole herd would go over the cliff. So there was tremendous waste there also.
In his memoirs, it's obvious that Hornaday really felt guilty about killing, what did he kill, 22 bison in his life, brought him back to the museum. Is that really the kickoff then of his change in heart and his decision to spend the rest of his days as a conservationist?
I think you could argue that, and he does, as you say, just very feelingly write about, look, he's mounting an expedition to go out west to find this endangered species on the brink of extinction and kill him. And it's heartbreaking to him. And when he comes back from that, the last buffalo hunt, he's like a man on fire. He's just like utterly consumed with this mission of bringing the plight of the buffalo to the American public and harnessing their rage. He creates this political organization called the American Bison Society, with Theodore Roosevelt as president and himself as kind of the actual president. He writes a book called The Extermination of the American Bison, just describing the particulars of what has happened. He starts a movement to create the first zoo, first national zoo, where they will begin captive breeding programs to restore the buffalo. And, you know, he's a guy who's almost like Roosevelt. He just seems to be living 10 lives at once, all to the purpose of saving this magnificent species, which is just a whisper away from extinction. You know, you started out with, let's say, 30 million bison, and when he discovered that there were no specimens left at the National Museum, he did this census of writing to ranchers and private landowners all over the country and came up with a number somewhere between 500 and 1,000 animals left on the planet, where there had been 30 million just a few decades earlier. I mean, it's truly fantastic.
When he brought the bison back from that great last buffalo hunt and exhibited them, what did that exhibit look like? How many were there? And it didn't last, I assume. I think there was something in your book sounded like the original exhibit may not be around anymore, or is it?
Well, you know, actually, there were six figures in this display. There was an absolutely magnificent bull. There was a calf, which they had found alive and brought back in a baggage car. And he lived for a few months and then died, and then he became a kind of a character in this display, and there were several cows. The picture was that they were a herd of bison visiting this little watering hole, and it went on display at the Smithsonian in the downstairs lobby, and it was on display for 70 years. So it was viewed by millions and millions of people. This is the expiation of his sins, you know. This is why he felt like it was justifiable to take these specimens.
You're listening to Stefan Bechtel. He's the author of Mr. Hornaday's War, How a Peculiar Victorian Zookeeper Waged a Lonely Crusade for Wildlife That Changed the World. Now, of course, today when we read your book, Stefan, we can, of course, look upon Mr. Hornaday as a conservation hero. What was it like in his day to come back with these bison, to raise this red flag about the buffalo populations and other dwindling wildlife? Was he as popular in the current culture of the late 19th century?
Well, if you go back 120 years or so to that time and take a look at the attitudes toward wildlife in America generally, it's a wonder there's any left at all. There was a general feeling that, you know, nature was limitless. And in fairness to the people at the time, it did seem limitless. For instance, there was a flock of passenger pigeons sometime in the mid-1800s that was observed by an ornithologist. He estimated that this flock was a mile wide, 300 miles long, and that it took 14 hours to pass a given point.
Wow.
I mean, how could there ever be an end to that? He estimated that this particular flock was probably in excess of a billion individuals. And, of course, in 1914, the last passenger pigeon died in a zoo in Cincinnati. So there wasn't a sense of the urgency that Hornaday had. And I think he tended to become treated as a crackpot. He was always standing on the roof with a tin pot, screaming and yelling and writing books and lecturing and making a lot of trouble and noise. And a lot of people got tired of him. They didn't like it because he was asking them to change. And they said, as you can imagine, they said, oh, Dr. Hornaday, he wants to take away our guns. He wants to make all hunting illegal. And he just said, no. I love to hunt. I love guns. In fact, there's almost nothing I love more. But unless there's some limits on bag limits and open seasons, and particularly on endangered species, these species are going to be gone. So it was kind of a real uphill battle for him to get his message through.
Well, I guess it's always an uphill battle for those who are clearly ahead of their time. And, you know, it reminds me of the fact that right before he died, you point out that he made one last request of President Franklin Roosevelt, and that was a 3-year ban on waterfowl hunting across the country.
That's right. I mean, he never gave up. I mean, Hornaday was dictating these letters to the president weeks before his death at 83 and still banging the same drum. You know, he spent 50 or 60 years of his life in this crusade. I mean, I use the word crusade in this book, and it's a fair word to use because it was like a religious crusade. But, you know, the attitudes that were prevalent in those days, for instance, back in the kind of Gilded Age or the 1880s, it was very much the fashion for women to go out in these fabulous hats adorned with feathers, huge things. So there was an ornithologist named Frank Chapman who took this famous walk through one of the fashionable districts of Manhattan with a little notebook just counting. And in one afternoon, he counted more than 700 ladies' hats adorned with the feathers from more than 40 species of birds, including the egret and bird of paradise and hummingbirds. And there were these tremendous feather dealing houses in Paris and London and New York. And if you actually sat down and looked at this and you did the numbers, you had to conclude this cannot last. I mean, this is impossible. But yet it was so common that at an early meeting of the Audubon Society in New York, a reporter could not help but notice that some of the good ladies that had come to save the birds were wearing these hats covered with feathers.
Bad form.
Bad form.
Well, Hornaday leaves this world, making this one last gesture or request of President Franklin D. Roosevelt. But in his younger years, it was President Theodore Roosevelt who he became friends with. Help us understand that friendship. How did that start, and what did these two have in common, and how did one influence the other?
Well, it started in an interesting way, and I believe it was 1888. Hornaday is back. This is after the Great Buffalo Hunt, and he's working on this display, this six-figure monumental display at the Hall of Mammals. And it's covered with a big canvas to keep the public out because he's still working and you know, nobody's allowed to go back there. And one day, somebody or other rips back the canvas and comes marching into this half-finished display, sticks out his hand, and doesn't introduce himself, and immediately starts talking to him about the bison and is fascinated by them and correctly guesses the weights and wants to know what kind of guns he used. And it was only after they'd been talking a while that Hornaday said, you know, excuse me, who are you again? I said, Theodore Roosevelt. And so this was their initial meeting. And Roosevelt had already become fairly famous because he had just run for mayor of New York and lost and had already gotten involved in ranching in Montana. I mean, One thing I discovered in writing this book is if you let Theodore Roosevelt into your book, he will take over. I mean, this guy is just beyond belief. I mean, he only lived to be 60 or 61 years old, and he just was everywhere. And another great thing about that initial meeting, which is described in Hornaday's unpublished autobiography, is that he said something like, "In that first hour we shared together, Roosevelt shared with me secrets that I've never shared with anyone." Wouldn't that be great?
No kidding. There's a book.
No kidding.
Well, what I'm fascinated by is the fact that Theodore Roosevelt is the guy who goes down in history as the great conservationist, and in many ways, like Hornaday, a guy who was this big game hunter at one point in his life. I guess the question I have is just what role does Hornaday play in making Theodore Roosevelt the great conservationist he became? I mean, you rightly point out that Theodore Roosevelt was everywhere, so maybe Hornaday is just a small chapter in his life when it comes to this conversion. Or was it the huge moment, Paul, you know, getting struck down off his horse?
I mean, I think they were just very simpatico from the very beginning. They just were pretty much on the same page. And, they were on the same page, at least partly, because they both were hunters. They loved to hunt. And but they could see they had traveled widely enough and were thoughtful enough that this just simply could not continue. And Roosevelt said, obviously when they first met, Roosevelt was not a president of the United States, but, boy, he was on his way, and he got there very quickly. And he told Hornaday, if you ever need anything, if you have pushed it as far as you can and you can't get any further, call me. Wouldn't it be great if the President of the United States told you that?
No kidding. So Hornaday also had something to do with the Bronx Zoo. And I guess these were the days when zoos were just starting up and bringing animals, live animals, that is, in from across the world.
Right. I mean, he was the founder and first director of the National Zoo in Washington, but very quickly got into a huge fight with his boss, Samuel Langley, and quit, and decided he was just going to leave conservation completely, and he and his wife, Josephine, moved to, of all places, Buffalo, New York. And Hornaday immediately set about this campaign to change the name of the town from Buffalo to Bison because it was more zoologically correct. I mean, this is the type of guy he was. And a few years later, just kind of out of the blue, he gets this letter from other important people that he knew in New York, and they said, well, we want to start a zoological park in New York, and would you consider becoming the director, which was a nice letter to get. And so he was there for 30 years, the director of the Bronx Zoo, and brought it to, it became world famous. They did start doing captive breeding and all kinds of other things, and that became kind of the platform. He became more and more famous and powerful and used that fame and power to fight for legislation on behalf of the animals.
Now, there is one incident in his 30-year career with the Bronx Zoo that's very difficult to explain, and I assume it must have been embarrassing for him in later life. Tell us about this weird thing he did.
Well, let's see. The short form of it is that, in 1904, there was a guy who was an anthropologist who set up this thing at the St. Louis World Fair. It was called the University of Man, which was a display of all the races. So you could go there and you could see the Eskimos of the Arctic and the American Indian and the black pygmies from Africa and, of course, the dominant whites. This was the way it was presented. This was anthropology in 1904. And as part of that, this tiny little man named Oda Benga was brought over from Africa. He was actually bought and was in the St. Louis World's Fair, and then after that was brought to the Bronx Zoo and temporarily allowed to stay there. So there was a series of, it was sort of a staged entry into something truly reprehensible. But it started out, he was just, allowed to stay on the grounds of the Bronx Zoo, and he was allowed to walk around in his little bark loincloth, and he developed a friendship with this orangutan, and there just happened to be this cage open in the monkey house, and he was encouraged to go in there, and there was a hammock, and you know, one thing led to another, and before you know it, he was living in the monkey house. And then someone, probably Hornaday, put out a sign that said something like, you know, Otabenga, Congo Free State, you know, his height and his weight, just as if he were, you know, a gorilla. Well, the word got out, and there was a tremendous hue and cry, particularly among black preachers in New York. But it also became wildly popular, and there was one day where 40,000 people came to see this Otabenga, who was kind of being called the only living cannibal in the United States. His teeth had been filed down to points as a child in Africa, and so it was, you know, easy enough to conclude that meant he was a cannibal. And eventually this exhibit was shut down after 18 days. But Hornaday never apologized, never understood why it was offensive. In some of his private writings, apparently believed that Otabenga was actually a subspecies of Homo sapiens. It was really reprehensible. And this may be partly why Hornaday has been so nearly forgotten by history, despite all the wonderful things that he did.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. Maybe that's exactly the reason why nobody's heard of him.
I think there was multiple reasons. I mean, he was a guy who was constantly fighting with people, and he got in fights even with his friends, like the Audubon Society. He had this lifelong feud with the Audubon Society. And the thing about Otabenga, I mean, how do you put a positive face on that? You don't. So, you know, here he is. He's this, I don't know if it's enigmatic character is the right word, but he did all these wonderful things. He left the world a better place. But yet there's this dark side that just, there it is. You can't explain it away.
Before Hornaday came along, was the federal government involved at all in wildlife preservation?
You know, very little. Very little. I mean, almost no one was involved in wildlife preservation. So you had to be considered kind of a nutcase. You know, he always reminded me of that, where the quote comes from, excuse me for the moment, but nothing is ever accomplished by a reasonable man. I mean, that phrase could have been written for Hornaday. He was utterly unreasonable, and he was someone who changed the world. And also, he was flawed.
You said you spoke to the Bison Society a few months ago in Denver. What's the difference between the bison that roamed the plains in the 19th century and those that are farmed and ranched today?
Yeah, well, there's approximately 500,000 bison living in the world today, but only about 30,000 of them are genetically pure. There's been this tremendous amount of interbreeding with cattle. That seems like a pretty high number, actually.
There are bison around Yellowstone Park, are there not?
Yes, and I couldn't tell you precisely, but most of them are considered to be genetically pure. There was actually another species of bison in the east, what they called the wood bison, slightly different. So there was some variation in the species.
Well, Stefan, our time is up for the day, but I've really enjoyed talking with you about the book. And again, the book is Mr. Hornaday's War, How a Peculiar Victorian Zookeeper Waged a Lonely Crusade for Wildlife That Changed the World. Thank you for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thanks very much, Bob. I really appreciate
it. I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Stefan Bechtel. Next week, Ian Baruma, author of Year Zero, A History of 1945. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Kathleen Tuck. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.